we are entering into the war against hegemonic West that has already begun to do that against us. It is just the delay, but now we are trying to save the time. And we are going to distribute nuclear weapon to everybody who can use it against the West.
This is the brilliance of the whole thing. Because now Putin is applying the new concept of indivisibility of security. And now what happens in Europe is tied up to what happens in Asia.
I think it is the beginning of the really global civil war. Not one nation against the other nation as in the Westphalian system, but something totally new. The civil war between globalists and their enemies on the global scale.
That's what it's so frustrating on a level that a lot of people, very well-informed people, for instance, in Berlin or in Paris, are thinking about the guillotine way out or the Mussolini hanging on the public square way out. There's no other way to talk to these people.
Hello, everyone. This is the New Rules Podcast, and I'm your host, Dimitri Symes Jr. We're back with another super episode. I want to welcome our two heavyweights today, political philosopher Alexander Dugin and veteran journalist Pepe Escobar.
Thank you.
You know, as with every episode, we're filming this during a time of crisis. So we're going to try and take all of the disparate events going on and try and provide you with a bigger picture. I want to start with you, Alexander Gilevich. I want to ask about the most recent events, because we're filming this podcast immediately after Putin's visit to North Korea and the trip of Russian warships to Cuba. I guess, what signal is Russia trying to send to the West, and what is motivating these two events?
So I think that all these events, including as well the visit of Mr. Putin to Vietnam as well, that we could add here rightfully. So it is the message. Russia is back. So you can enjoy it, you can blame it, but we are back. We have abandoned our attitude of polite, pro-Western, pro-liberal politics of the 90s forever. And now, if you declare ourselves the war, we accept it and we are going to strike back with all our capacities. So we pretended until now to try to reduce the conflict in Ukraine, not to get it to be something more than something regional, then special military operation. That was called that in order not to provoke global hostility, not to declare the war to the West. That was just defensive local operation. But we saw that in spite of our attitude, polite attitude, very correct attitude, the West declared the war against us. And now the masks are off. We are going to fight the West, the Western hegemony, with all the means we have. And we immediately rediscover Cuba, rediscover Nicaragua, Venezuela. We rediscover North Korea. We rediscover Houthi. We rediscover Vietnam, Iran. And we tried to keep the distance with these anti-globalist, anti-Western regimes before. But now it's time to abandon such polite attitude, and we are entering into the war against hegemonic West that has already begun to do that against us. It is just the delay. But now we are trying to save the time, and we are going to distribute nuclear weapon to everybody who can use it against the West. Let's acknowledge that if the West could give nuclear weapon to Israel against Iran and pretend that nothing happened, we are going to overcome all the restrictions, all red lines, because nobody respect our red lines. If you don't respect what we mean by red lines, so we are not going to respect your red lines. So I think we are going to supply all kind of strategical weapon to all enemies of American hegemony, Western hegemony against NATO, starting from Middle East to the Far East to North America. We are going to war. And I think that this science of Cuba, of a Russian military ship and submarines, and the talks about re-established the military base in Vietnam and in Cuba, and I think Russia does resistance. Now we consider ourselves in the place of the global resistance against Western hegemony, because we are victim of what we consider to be the attack of the West against us.
So would it be fair to say that Russia is preparing for World War III?
Absolutely, because it is imposed on us. It is not our will, it is not our desire, but we are ready to fight it, and now we have abandoned all the measures, all the limits that kept us in the context of the respect of the old rules. We saw that the West doesn't respect its own rules, or so-called rules based world order. And the reality is double standard. So there are no rules. And if there are no rules, we are going to insist on our own rules, and in order to promote our sovereignty, independence, and our own sovereign understanding of how the world architecture should be, we are ready to fight for that, and to, if necessary, to fight the Third World War.
So, Pepe, I want to throw the ball in your court. How do you interpret Putin's visit to North Korea, the visit of Russian warships to Cuba? Do you have a similar interpretation as Alexander Gilevich?
Yes, it's similar in the sense that the masks are off. I would prefer to focus on the absolutely outstanding diplomatic and geopolitical move of this comprehensive strategic partnership, Russia, North Korea. I'm sure you and Alexander and our audience, you must remember end of 2021 when Russia was proposing indivisibility of security. Basically, the concept of indivisibility of security would apply to the NATO space, to Western Europe, to Eastern Europe, and to the post-Soviet space. Nobody was talking about Asia at the time. This would be a new concept of Eurasian or pan-Eurasian security. The way I interpret this comprehensive strategic partnership Russia-North Korea is Putin starting the basis for a completely new pan-Eurasian security arrangement. This is so mind-boggling that I can't understand how the elites in the Beltway, they are catatonic. They still don't understand what's going on. Because pay attention to the connection, very indirect connection that Putin made between when he was talking about the agreement itself. Immediately afterwards, he mentioned supply of weapons by the West to Kiev to use for attacks inside the Russian Federation. What is he implying by that? Okay, if you, rules-based international order, can do that against us, we, with our partners, can do absolutely the same thing, symmetrically or asymmetrically, against you. Example, North Korea, if Russia is attacked, considering that they have a strategic partnership, so an attack on one of them is an attack on both, they can, let's say, do a few things against the empire of bases in Northeast Asia, for instance. So this is the brilliance of the whole thing. Because now Putin is applying the new concept of indivisibility of security. And now what happens in Europe is tied up to what happens in Asia. And that's why this is a new trans-Eurasia reality. And it's going to be very hard for the think tanks in D.C. to understand how this is going to work.
You know, all of this talk reminds me of what Putin said earlier this month, right before the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. He said that Russia is considering sending weapons to Western adversaries. So, Alexander Gilevich, would it be fair to say that now, you know, proxy wars are a two-way street, and that the West has been waging a proxy war against Russia and Ukraine, and Russia is now preparing to do the favor elsewhere in the world by waging a proxy war against the West?
I think that is exactly so. For example, we could remark as well our relations with Taliban, still prohibited in Russia, but we are on the way to decriminalize Taliban. You see that now the Iranian gods, the gods of Iranian revolutions, are considered in the West as terrorist organization, and we will develop all kind of mutual relations with this organization, supplying it with all kind of military infrastructure it needs. The same with Hezbollah in Lebanon. And I think we shouldn't stop here. We should help to position against globalist elite inside of the West, trying to supply all kind of the help to political opposition to globalists in the United States, in Europe, and trying to get in touch with Mexico. Mexican president, new elected woman, is against Ukraine, is against globalism. So I think that is a kind of pan-human, planetarian strategy, new strategy that could be considered as counterattack of the multipolar world order promoted by Russia, but as well by China and by other civilizations against Western hegemony. And I think that escalation that is growing, before it was controlled escalation controlled by the West. In the Western strategy, there is the theory, military theory, of controlled escalation. And the key point in the strategy is you should always be in control of that. If you escalate, you have to have the issue of it. When it arrives to some point, you are going to lose the control, you stop it. But it is one street strategy. If there is someone, on the other hand, who understands this strategy, so we could hijack the process of escalation. We could undermine this this idea of the West that they could control escalation until the critical point. No, we should destroy this process. We should undermine the strategy and to try to disrupt all this system. If you want escalation, you will receive it, but without the control. It is not only you who control escalation. It is two-way street. So, and that is very important now. That is why we are going to use all the capacities we have on the global scale, not only in Asia with North Korea, with big economical relations with China, but as well our relations with India, with Islamic world, with Africa, with Latin America, with the Western groups of population who hate globalists as we do. So I think it is the beginning of the really global civil war. Not one nation against the other nation as in the Westphalian system, but something totally new. The civil war between globalists and their enemies on the global scale. The only way to avoid it, I think, now it is election of Trump. So the only man who can save the humanity of this uncontrolled escalation is Donald Trump, because that, I think, it is the leader that we still respect in the West and with whom we could really coordinate, with whom we can make a bargain and in whom we could trust. And that is why the globalists now try to eliminate this possibility. So I think to be or not to be, now it is Trump or not to Trump. So something like that. So otherwise, if Biden, not because of his individual capacities, but because of the groups that are behind him, so if Biden will still represent the West, so I think the Third World War, nuclear world war, is inevitable somehow.
Pepe, do you think Trump is the person who can save the West from calamity and help avoid World War III, or is he not up to that task?
Well, I beg to disagree, respectfully. No, not really. He's a pragmatist. He doesn't know much about international relations, not to mention he doesn't know anything about Eurasia as a whole and the reconfiguration of Eurasia. It depends on his relationship. It will depend on his relationship with the deep state, which will be, of course, a total war against him, because the deep state won't be renewed with the election of Trump. The usual suspects will continue to be there, especially CIA, Department of State, as you know well. So the thing is, Trump, no Trump, post-Trump, or an outsider, they simply cannot understand the way international relations are being reconfigured today, to start with geoeconomically. They, for instance, it would take them 2 days at the St. Petersburg Forum to see which way the wind is blowing. You saw only a few Americans, and they were all dissidents. Nobody from an official position. Europeans, the same thing. Now, I'll give an example. There was a fascinating session on the Greater Eurasia Partnership, which is a Russian concept, first outlined by President Putin, and then Sergei Karaganov more or less conceptualized it. On the table, we had Sergei Glazyev talking about geoeconomics, Russian ministers, the former Austrian foreign minister Karin Neissel talking a little bit about the decline of Europe, and guess who? The Taliban minister of labor on the same table talking about integrating Afghanistan into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. This is something that is... Look, even for us who follow Eurasia, was something really mind-boggling. And after that, the Russians were, you know, working the room with the Taliban delegation, presenting them to, you know, people from everywhere, from Persian Gulf, from Siberia, from China, from India, etc. This is, an illustration of how things are progressing so fast here. You had in St. Petersburg sessions on the Northern Silk Road, which is going to be the alternative to the Suez Canal. You had sessions on the International North-South Transportation Corridor, which will be the alternative Russia, Iran, Persian Gulf, Mumbai in India. You had sessions on the integration between the Eurasian Economic Union and ASEAN, Southeast Asia. And all that in one day. So the amount of information and the amount of interconnections is so enormous that even people who live in the region strive to keep up. Imagine on the other side of the Atlantic. They have no idea what's going on. They're totally lost. They only have a plan B, which is more sanctions, more threats, and more escalation, which is what they're trying to do with Russia now. And with Trump, this is not going to change much, because he will be under pressure all the time. So there will be more threats, but against China, more against China than against Russia.
And maybe Iran as well.
And there will be much more escalation vis-a-vis Iran, because this is, for Republicans, this is a bête noire. Completely. They're upset. They're still obsessed with Iran. And these, the Republican neocons are more obsessed with Iran than the Democrat neocons. The Democrat neocons are obsessed with Russia, essentially.
So, Alexander Gerich, I guess I want to continue on the theme with Trump a little bit, because, you know, listening to what Pepe said, I remember what Comrade Stalin once said, personnel determine everything. And so even if Trump were to come to office and he were to rediscover his internal Richard Nixon, someone who has ideas, someone who has a clear vision of what he wants, wouldn't it be really difficult for him to find like-minded people who are capable of completely overhauling a degraded and, you know, demented American political system?
So first of all, if we consider the only possibility, the isolated possibility to shift the aggression from Russia to China or to Iran, we are already have de-escalated everything, because now we are on the edge of the full-scale strategic nuclear war. And if they will stop that, if Trump will stop this kind of escalation, humanity has already gained the time, because the conflict, possible ongoing future conflict about Taiwan with China is one thing. Hardening relations between Iran and Israel, or the force of resistance in Middle East and Israel, is another thing. And the nuclear war today or tomorrow is something totally different. Trump comes to power, the immediate threat of total annihilation of the humanity is put aside. It is not totally abandoned, it is not totally overcome, but it is at least put aside. Second, I think that, imagine Trump wins. Deep state, American deep states immediately understands that his first coming to power was not just joke, just a kind of something unusual. So there is a tendency in the American society to refuse the globalist agenda in the political way. So deep state, who is based on the pragmatic interests and not by some fanatic ideas about destruction of the humanity in order to impose by power a so-called open society, and that is not the case of deep state. They have they don't bother about open society. They are in charge to make America prosperous, powerful, independent, sovereign, hegemonic, yes, but they have nothing to do with this agenda of the swamp of globalists. And they will immediately remark that Trump was something much more than exception. That is tendency. And if Trump and Trumpism is tendency and not just isolated case, so they will shift their attitude and they will arrive to the acceptance sooner or later of multipolarity instead, in spite of them. Not because they understand that very well, but they will be obliged to deal and to operate, to think in terms of multipolarity. That is, as Pepe has explained, is already here. It is not something invented. It is something that is already in the reality, but the globalists fanatics don't want to perceive it, to observe it, to accept it. And third level, I think the power of Trump consists, in fact, to have no group around him. So he is absolutely narcissistic individualism, and that is his power, because everybody in the most people in American political and political establishment is corrupted, Democratic, Republican, neocons, corrupted by one or other form. So Trump relies on himself, and that is a good thing. So he's something more than just marionette, the puppet put by this or that lobby. He is himself. He represents the lost American formula, the lost archetype. So be yourself, go ahead, rely on yourself, and you will win. So that is the great, almost forgotten narrative of American history, American society. And it has in itself the great archetypal power. So I believe in Trump as totally isolated person, but he is as well businessman. If you propose to businessmen to sacrifice humanity for some abstract ideal of global liberal democracy, gay marriages, artificial intelligence, and feminist politics, the businessmen would answer, if I do that, I will lose everything. It is not rational. I will not gain, I will lose. And I think this purely pragmatic, materialist, businessman way of making politics today is the only solution, it's salvation for the humanity. We need Trump. It is not the gift. It is not something that could give us the way. He has no mission. Except one mission, to save humanity from American rotten globalist elite. But that is the huge, that is catatonic mission in the American reality.
Yeah. Pepe, I want to, Alexander makes an interesting point about the fact, about the potential response of the U.S. deep state to another Trump victory, because as Alexander argues, the U.S. deep state, if they see yet another Trump victory, even more resounding than the one in 2016, and you couple this with failures at home, failures abroad, even, demented people at some point have to look reality in the mirror and make adjustments. So, looking not only at the U.S. elite, but at the European elite, if we continue to see populist attitudes growing, if we continue to see problems fester at home and abroad, do you think that the current Western elite is capable of adjusting and learning from mistakes, or are they too much captives of them in order to change anything?
The short answer is no. I live part-time of the year, I live in Europe, and wow. And now it's going to get even worse, because even after these European elections, which changed the chessboard a little bit towards, let's say, center-right, not extreme-right, basically center-right, conservative values, people that are fed up with Brussels, etc. The next leader of the European Commission is going to be, once again, is going to be Ursula von der Leyen 2.0. So this is not going to, they're going to decide this next week. It is already decided, because her party won the largest number of votes. Obviously, she knows all the leaders of the 27, she cultivates them. They work for her, essentially. The capitals in Europe work for the European Commission. And she's the most powerful European official of them all. The leader of foreign policy of the current little garden, Borrell, it's ridiculous. He's going to be substituted by another little garden, probably the prime minister of Estonia. So in terms of Russophobia, it's going to be as it is nowadays, if not even worse. So the structure of the European Union, the European Commission, the way power is articulated in Brussels will continue to be, even if we have a Trump in the US, what it is now. And we all know what it means now, right? When we hear Stoltenberg and when we hear von der Leyen, it's the same script with the same words, with the same expressions. And they go all the way. There's not even a small window in the attic. Okay, let's try to a little bit of diplomacy. No, forget it. So this, assuming there is a change in the White House, Europe, which is already isolated, will become even more self-isolated. Coming back to our friend Eric Lee's wonderful formulation, Eric Lee was at the St. Petersburg Forum. His formulation is fantastic, defining Europe as a small garden, high walls. So it's a small rotten garden. Who erected these high walls? And now it's inside. And obviously they cannot, it's a different formulation of Plato's cave, in fact. They simply cannot see reality outside. And even when European citizens go to the polls and say, we want you out, nothing changes. That's what it's so frustrating on a level that a lot of people, very well-informed people, for instance, in Berlin or in Paris, are thinking about the guillotine way out or the Mussolini hanging on the public square way out. There's no other way to talk to these people. They are immune, they are barricaded, and they're going to be even more barricaded, irrespective of any votes for the European Parliament in these fake new elections in France, which everybody knows it's a form of divide and rule as well. Nothing substantially changes. But the problem is, Dimitri and Alexander, you don't hear practically no intellectuals in these key European countries detailing ways out of it. Like, you have Emmanuel Todd in France, who's probably the only one. You have two
Alain
or three.
De Benoit.
You have Alain de Benoit, exactly. So you have two or three in France and three or four in Italy in alternative channels and in university, they are under tremendous pressure. And in Germany, they are completely catatonic.
One.
I'm sorry?
No one in Germany.
You're right, exactly. I was going to say that. No one in Germany. Which is completely, you know, the best critics of what's happening in Germany are financial specialists. I'm in contact with some of them. They are absolutely terrified. But then they say, look, there's nothing we can do. We work with markets, we work with finance. We cannot depose a government. You see?
There is an interesting aspect. Because Europe is not responsible, because Europe is not sovereign, Putin many times has said that, and I think that and America is responsible. And I think that deep state of United States of America is the bearer of real responsibility, because finally, at the end of the day, only this instance could define, could decide either we have the life on the planet or not, or humanity
True.
On the planet. So
mm-hmm.
They are in a position to be responsible, and they could not be reduced only to Democrats. They are bipartisan. Deep state in America controls or observes somehow Democrats and Republicans, and it makes some adaptation to rule of one or other, but it exists. And there is no such thing as European deep state. No French, neither
it's
German.
NATO.
Absolutely, it's garden with the wall. It's just a rotten garden, and they are out of the history. They are used as Ukrainians are in this global situation, and I think that there is the power behind Biden, behind Democrats, behind Republicans, and this power is American deep state. And that is very interesting because we have many myths about what is does it exist at all? We wonder, we are guessing. But if such instance as American deep state is, it is precisely the only hope that we still have, not Europe. Europe is totally out of the history now.
Exactly.
Russia is in the history. The global South is returning to the history. China is one of the historic power, including North Korean leader is the concept of subject, to be sovereign subject.
Autonomous, self-reliant.
Absolutely, it is Chuche, the concept, the theory, political theory of North Korea. It is not Marxism-Leninism, it is a totally different thing. So everybody who is really the subject is either outside of the West or American deep state. So that is, I think, why these upcoming elections in the United States are so important. And I think that not exactly and only personally Trump, but American deep state could change the situation and de-escalate it. If we de-escalate it now, everything will be possible, including new awakening of Europe, the redistribution of powers on the global levels. Everything will be possible after the escalation. But with Biden, no chance. With Democrats, no chance to imagine, to hope, to dream the escalation. The humanity needs now either the escalation or the death, nothing.
You know, and on that front, setting aside the US elections for a moment, I want to return to the issue of hybrid wars, because you outlined a very interesting plan of action for Russia in your first answer. You said that one of the things Russia could do is to begin supplying nuclear weapons to the West adversaries across the world. I can already imagine that people in the comments section to this video will be actively discussing that part of the answer. So could you elaborate on it? Why would it be in Russia's interest to do it? How do you see this being done?
More people and more not Western powers have nuclear weapon, less chances for the nuclear war. Because the tension, precisely, it is the meaning of nuclear weapon. If there is the huge potential on one side and nothing at other side, this potential, this power who has the huge amount of nuclear weapon could dictate to the other how to behave. And our principle of our not proliferation strategy was based on the bipolar distribution of these nuclear powers. So we, as Soviet Union, including the countries of Warsaw Pact, we had one half of this nuclear weapon, and the Western camp had the other half. And we didn't want to give nuclear weapon to anybody else, because the responsibility to stop the war was precisely only on Moscow and Washington, nobody else. And we didn't want any other players in that. So we distributed or helped to have to get nuclear weapon only to those who were with us. So the United States has supplied Pakistan. We have helped to India as balance for Pakistan, and so on. Now there is multipolarity. It is not anymore bipolar system. So, and the only way to respond a nuclear unipolarity of the Western hegemony is to distribute evenly nuclear weapons to different global actors in order to establish nuclear multipolar peace. We could not rely anymore on the United States because Biden and before him Obama and George Bush Jr. and Clinton, they have missed the chance to lead the world. They have lost it forever, I think. So no more. Nobody will trust to in the United States and its capacity to lead the world. So everybody should think on its own account. So everybody need to be defended from possible aggression of this aggressive hegemon. Is it aggressive? We could clearly prove that in Ukraine, in Gaza, in Middle East. So we need to stop Western hegemony that is based among other elements on nuclear weapons. So we need to evenly distribute nuclear weapon in order to not let nuclear strike to happen. This is only way because we need to re-establish, re-emulate world order. This unipolar world order, it is not the peace, it is the war. It is the threat. It is uncontrolled, finally, against all the pretensions, escalation. So I think that we need totally revise non-proliferation strategy and to give strategical means of self-defense to those who are against global hegemony.
Pepe, let's assume that Russia maybe doesn't go so far as provide nuclear weapons to Western adversaries, but let's say it decides to do drones, to do tanks, to do long-range missiles, the same things that the West has been providing to Ukraine. Are Western governments ready to deal with that kind of escalation?
Definitely not. Okay. Let me bring it down a little bit to the ground level, non-nuclear, everyday life, and geoeconomics. I think it's important for our discussion. What basically the US, starting with the Treasury Department, going all the way to the non-diplomatic State Department, the National Security Council, etc. What they are absolutely terrified is those moves towards de-dollarization. So to start all, you know, the lineaments of a new multipolar, multinodal, and as President Putin said, harmonic multipolar world, you have to find ways to not deal most of your transactions with the currency of your enemy. Common sense, number one. The problem is, if you talk to any financial expert, say, look, the system works by inertia. Everybody who deals with finance, everybody who trades globally, big companies, they are used to the inertia of the system. So to change the system, even mid-term, it's a titanic effort. The good thing is that Russia and China are up to the challenge, and even Saudi Arabia. Because Mohammed bin Salman, he looked at which way the wind is blowing, and now he is betting totally on the petro yuan. That's number one. Number two, the Russian efforts. There are three different levels. One of them is they were thinking about the previous idea of, okay, a new currency based on gold and a basket of currencies. No, that's too complicated. Let's try something different, which is the concept of the unit, which is the three guys who invented the unit. Two are Russians, one is Chinese. It's basically a new unity of value for transborder payments and apolitical, immune to foreign interference. Then there is something that the Russians call BRICS Bridge. which is based on a system called M-Bridge, Bank of International Settlements. Some people are already using it. The Chinese are in. Thais are in. The Hong Kong Monetary Authority is in. And now Saudi Arabia as well. So I'll give you an example. The Thais, they buy oil from the Emirates, and they pay with this system called M-Bridge. Very simple, straightforward, no interference, etc. Can you imagine Saudi Arabia selling the Petro 1 in enormous quantities using this system? That's already one step ahead. And then all these systems are being discussed before the summit of the BRICS in October. So we all expect that something tangible will arrive at the table in October in Kazan and say, look, this is our roadmap for trans-border payments and for progressive de-dollarization. It's a long story. It's going to take at least a decade, if not more. But this is the most important element, even more important than military clashes, in fact. The geoeconomic reorganization of the world is essential to create a multipolar world. Otherwise, we'll be running in circles.
You know, and as our time comes to a close, we've talked about Russia, we've talked about Trump, we've talked about Europe, we've talked about de-dollarization, we've even talked about Asia and North Korea, but we haven't talked much about the Middle East. So for my final question, I have to ask about what's going on right now, because both Israel and Hezbollah have signaled that they are prepared for a large-scale war. Starting with you, Alexander Gilevich, what do you think the broader geopolitical significance of that coming to fruition would be?
I think that the Gaza war, that is the beginning of escalation of relations between Israel and Lebanon with Hezbollah and ongoing future imminent war. I think all that was the element of the global resistance or global revolt against unipolarity. Israel is kind of proxy of United States in the Middle East. It is not totally totally controlled by United States, but nevertheless, all the support or the supply or all the help, military, financial, diplomatic, political, to Israel is provided by Washington. So Hamas has attacked not so much Israelis, but provoked a kind of resistance, awakening of resistance in Middle East. It was the idea. So Hamas could not count on the victory over Israel. They just wanted to start some regional conflict and to open the second front. The first front is obviously Ukraine, where the global majority, the humanity, is fighting globalists. So in Gaza, that was the second front opened by a radical and terrorist attack. I don't approve it at all. But response of Israel was just a genocide, the pure, a clear genocide, totally supported by the West. So, step by step, the conflict in Gaza is becoming the full-scale war between the powers of resistance in Middle East, Lebanon, Syria, I think Iraq and Iran as well, against not so much Israel, but against the West. So I think the beginning of this attack of Hamas was precisely that. The goal was not to win Israel. That is ridiculous. But to start the global Middle Eastern intifada, not so much against Israel, but against the West. A second point, I think that Netanyahu wants that because it helps to him to save his own position. He is far right, radical ultra-nationalist in Israel politics, and the war gives him the opportunity to keep the power, to realize its own or far-right hopes on second coming of Mashiach. That leads to this destruction of Al-Aqsa Mosque and beginning of the building of third temple. That is the clearly far-right agenda of Israel, Israel far-right. So that is they consider the war against Arab, including genocide, genocidal war, as the part of this eschatological scenario in order to blow up Al-Aqsa and to start to build third temple. That is Israeli far-right agenda. So and the Shia, who are much more active, they regard the situation as well in the same eschatological perspective, because for Shia believes that the final war between believers, Muslims, and Dajjal, a kind of Antichrist, will start in the Palestine, will start in the Syria, in the Holy Land, and in Jerusalem. So we see the second front broadening in Middle East, and we need at the same time is the hard blow against Biden. I think the third elements, because Biden tried until now to present himself as kind of, despite all, peaceful and balanced and helping to Arabs, to Muslims. And now it is clear that United States and his administration demonstrate the same double standards as in the case of Ukraine. So nobody would believe in their peaceful desires or wishes. So the masks here as well are off once more. So everything becomes finally clear, transparent, I would say. And in next talk, sometimes I think we will discuss third front in the Pacific Ocean. It is waiting. That is the third front of the global war between multipolarity against unipolarity, and Africa and Latin America and maybe Europe are as well the new spaces of this global war that started in Ukraine. Now it is continuing in the Middle East and everywhere. And after that, everywhere. So I think that is very ominous. That is very horrible. But at the same time, I think it is inevitable. So we need to accept the reality as it is, outside of these pacifist myths that simply don't work anymore.
Pepe, same question to you. Hezbollah and Israel are inching towards a large-scale war. What do you think the larger implications of that would be?
Hezbollah doesn't want a war. A war is being forced on Hezbollah. It's a completely different story. They know it. The last speech by Sheikh Nasrallah was something absolutely extraordinary. And Nasrallah never threatens. He's very measured, very calculating. But this time you could see that he was up a notch already. He said, okay, you want to do this, you will regret it. That's the gist of his speech. The Houthis, the greatest pop star in the Islamic world probably ever, or at least for the past millennia. Why they are admired not only across the lands of Islam, but all across the global majority? Because they are actually doing something practical to at least alleviate something and try to prove to those Talmudic, psychopathological, genocidals, whatever, which way we want to decide it. Why don't you say, you should start thinking about it. You want your economy destroyed, you want to be even more isolated than you already are. And it's a position of principle. That's the beauty of it. The Prime Minister of Yemen talks about defending our people. This is fascinating. It's much more than Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, or Turkey are doing. And then we get into a long discussion, we should have it another time, those divisions inside Islam on how to really help Palestine. Very few are actually helping in practice. Iran, Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq, the Axis of Resistance, of course, Hezbollah, Yemen, and not much else, unfortunately. So the good part of it is that the axis of resistance is moving, and now the axis of resistance is a concept that the whole global majority thinks about and is in awe, in fact. And there are other axes. There's the axis of the Sahel now. There's the axis in Africa, from Senegal all the way to Eritrea and Ethiopia. And guess who's on the other side of Ethiopia? Yemen. So Yemen, sooner or later, is going to be part of BRICS. Ethiopia was brought into BRICS by a strategic decision by Russia and China specifically. And Yemen, sooner or later, they will come in as a... So now this, all these accesses and what they are doing is coalescing into something much bigger geopolitically. Like we can make a comparison between axis of resistance in West Asia and the axis of resistance Christian Orthodox in Donbass. Because the fight is absolutely the same. The enemy is the same. So the great thing is that people in Latin America or in Africa are starting to make these connections. And that's the new, I would say, geopolitical reorganization that starts in the minds of average people, not only among leaderships. And for the past few months, you can see that compared to a year, two, 3 years ago, you know, the leap forward, it's a real, to quote Mao, great leap forward.
So I think that Houthis and Yemenis, they do and practice what everybody else only dream of.
Dream of doing. You're right. Yes, absolutely.
So that's why they are so popular. And they should be in BRICS. We need to invite them.
Yeah. If anyone from the Houthis is watching this, we invite you on this podcast. We're happy to have you anytime. And I want to thank Pepe,
thank you.
Alexander, it's always a pleasure having you on. The only problem is that our viewers always want more. But, you know, I want to thank everyone who tuned into this super episode. Please like it, share it, help spread the wisdom around, and subscribe to us on X and on Rumble. And also make sure to subscribe to these gentlemen on X. They both have great channels. You get a lot of wisdom there. Thank you all for tuning in. Till next time.